please be seated. This is the time and place set for oral argument in the case entitled OTEC Nevada LLC versus District Court, True Party of Interest Pacific Cap Construction, case number 59050. Is counsel ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Please do.
Good afternoon. My name is Nick Wazurek. I am counsel for OTEC Nevada in this matter. I would request a reservation of 4 minutes of time for rebuttal if I might.
Yes, that's fine.
We appreciate the opportunity to present to the court today issues of importance with respect to Nevada's good faith settlement statute, NRS 17.245. We think it's especially appropriate in the context of this petition for writ of mandamus review that we are in a position to discuss questions which warrant the court's immediate review. Certainly in the context of the guidelines that the court has articulated in cases such as D.R. Horton, where matters of interpretation of a statute are of great importance to the district courts and the litigants in cases, the immediate review is appropriate and warranted. And certainly under IGT, where even in a case where a trial court denies a motion to dismiss a matter, where issues of importance regarding statutory interpretation are involved, immediate review is warranted. And here, we certainly believe that is the appropriate action. The respondent trial court in this case considered 17.245 in the context of some claims dismissed or discharged, and in our view at least misapplied the statutory intent, which again warrants the court's immediate action today. As we know, this is this case's second appearance before the court. One would have thought that after OTAC 1 was issued, it might have put this litigation to an end. However, it did not. And as this particular writ was pending, and this court was issuing its decision in OTAC 1, actions were going on within the trial court which have kept this litigation moving forward. We note and we observe that even before the court scheduled this matter for full briefing, there was an order to show cause regarding whether this writ had been rendered moot by the decision in OTAC 1. And the answer to that, of course, was no. As it played out in the trial court, after OTAC 1, the case was not disposed of, but was resurrected through what we believe was a calculated strategy by real parties to plead around OTAC 1 and plead around OTAC's good faith settlement determination, which had it had obtained in the case, in order to keep alive what we believe is a clear contribution action dressed up as an indemnity claim. OTAC 1 certainly cleared the field for the court, however, and despite the voluminous record which has accompanied this writ, the issue here is very simple, and that is the only operative pleading being in play right now is the third-party complaint filed by real parties. All of the other matters pertaining to claims, cross-claims, and the third-party actions were swept clean by OTAC 1. So the document that we're here to examine today is very clear. And we note that that third-party complaint was filed on September 14, 2011, which was 6 days after the OTAC 1 decision was rendered. It was filed in a manner that had been set up by real parties and the trial court, in our view, again, to potentially frustrate what should have been the outcome of OTAC 1 and the disposition of this matter once and for all.
That being the case, make your case for me that there is irreparable injury that you will suffer if extraordinary writ relief does not issue from this court. Why not just let it play out between these parties in the district court?
This litigation has been playing out for 6 years, if you count the date of the accident.
I understand that, but you just said that it's now down to a third-party complaint.
It is. It is. And the issues have been the issues are there in front of this court for consideration. Continuing on in the trial court, on the one hand, serves no purpose other than to result in further cost to the litigant, which is a factor, certainly not dispositive. But the procedural groundwork that got us here today, we believe, makes this absolutely right for determination at this time, and no need to defer further for an ultimate trial court finding, because there are orders of good faith settlement, there are orders granting good faith settlement, there are orders denying summary judgment on derivative issues, and there are good faith settlement determinations. So the table has been set. And again, the thing that's driving this case further is what we believe was the respondent court's misapprehension of 17245. We don't have a lot of case law here in Nevada interpreting that language, especially after the 97 amendments.
But the harm your client would suffer were writ relief not to issue would be proceeding to trial on the claims that Judge Smith has said he would allow to proceed.
Proceeding to trial and potentially facing a judgment, which would bring us back to a crash for a third time, but a judgment well in excess of what OTAC calculated when it made its application for good faith settlement, which, you know, the adage about that practice is you want to buy your piece in a case.
As we I understand that. Class. I was just curious about the...
To follow up on the Chief's question, if what you present appears to be a purely legal question, if the claims that are the subject of the third-party complaint are barred as de facto contribution and indemnity, equitable indemnity claims under 17245, the case is over. Perhaps you ought to argue why that's an important issue of first impression.
Well, that is the fact, Your Honor, and it is a pure question of law, because Jeff Smith, in granting good faith settlement while also denying summary judgment, engaged in what we think is a medallion-like analysis of 17245, a very literal reading of medallion, as opposed to what we think was the appropriate task of piercing the allegations in the complaint to get to the heart of the matter. So you are correct. I mean, there is the facts are there. It is a purely legal interpretation of how this statute applies, and Judge Smith, in our view at least, misapprehended it.
Well, another aspect of the issue here is whether the one, maybe two claims, breach of contract, breach of covenant of good faith and fair dealing, should be accepted from the de facto claims that might otherwise cover the other issues raised in the third-party complaint. Why not?
Well, you need to look at those claims, again, in the context of what this case is about. It was in May of 2011 that OTAC settled, assessed its risk, weighed its options, and entered into a settlement. It was within weeks of oral argument on OTAC 1 that real parties weighed their risks, made their decisions, and entered into a settlement. Both parties got good faith settlement determinations. The interpretation going forward is simply that. How do you enforce and what is covered by a good faith settlement?
On the contract claims, if you had express indemnity, that would not have been precluded or concluded by a good faith settlement determination.
If the contract expressly provided that real parties were to be indemnified, we might be having a different story.
And they're arguing that they have a species of express indemnity claim, correct?
They argue that they have an argument on express indemnity based on how they read the contract. But again...
So why, following up on Justice Hardesty's question, why should that not be allowed to be sorted out in the district court?
Because there was no breach of agreement other than as it might apply to responsibility to plaintiffs as between parties and OTAC as co-tortfeasors. The breach of contract simply pleads that you, OTAC, you failed your standard of care, you were supposed to be out at the job site more frequently, and accordingly we had to pay for you. That is the breach alleged. There is no independent harm being alleged. There is no independent damage being alleged. It's all we paid on your behalf. You should pay us back.
Right, but if they had an express indemnity contract claim, they would be entitled to assert that, notwithstanding what you just said.
Correct, but we obviously have a disagreement as to whether it's an expressly provided for indemnity clause under Article 10. Article 10, if as the court has before it, is, in our view, certainly not an agreement that expressly provides for OTAC to indemnify real parties.
Your point on that is Orion has a claim back against OTAC, but it doesn't give Cheyenne any claim against Orion?
Absolutely. The agreement between OTAC and Cheyenne excluded express indemnity. So they can't use that. So they have to attempt to back into the agreement through the Orion-OTAC agreement, say, well, we're either a beneficiary or a third-party beneficiary. And the language, I don't think, supports that because it is apportioning of risk provision, apportioning of risk being contribution. There's never been a serious argument posed in any of the briefing, in any of this case, that real parties believe OTAC should bear full freight for the entire settlement they paid. The facts of this case militate toward multiple and disparate causes of this terrible accident. OTAC did not put shovels in the ground. OTAC was not building this road. OTAC cannot be responsible for the entirety of it, therefore it is not indemnity, it's contribution.
Did you consider your client a peripheral defendant in this matter? I mean, you settled for $45,000, it was a fatality case. I'm sure the plaintiffs were asking for much more than $45,000.
Plaintiffs never pursued OTAC for a variety of their reasons. They obviously felt they had a more direct action against the developer and the contractor, but the distinction here is, yes, OTAC never thought it was a player in this case anyway. It was brought in under an argument of an interpretation of its AIA contract saying you have to visit the site at intervals. We've seen that all the time.
Yeah, Justice Sade and I heard a lot about peripheral defense when we did the construction defect. I know you participated in that.
You lived it as I did, that parties tend to be brought into these types of actions, typically a Chapter 30 proceeding, and we sort out the facts later, but here, the other point is OTAC never acquiesced in an argument that it was responsible for this. But it was embroiled in litigation that took years and wasted a large amount of its financial resources to get to the point where it thought it could get out under a good faith settlement. I mean, and that was the driving force behind this. We could have, on principle, OTAC could have, on principle, litigated this to the bitter end of what's left of its financial situation. So, certainly going back to the 17245, the policy of the courts in Nevada is to encourage resolution of disputes.
I watched a lot of good faith settlements in the MGM litigation. They ended once there was a settlement by a defendant. It was over.
Right, and you don't have finality in this case. OTAC has what real parties would like to call just, it's a paper order, but of no effect because they assert that they have rights above and beyond 17245. Again, going back to the causes of action pled, be it breach of contract, breach of the covenant, punitive damages, express contribution, which I don't even know what that is, the attorney would simply plead around the definitions of discharge claims in 17245. And again, we encourage that the interpretation must be more result-driven, more practical-driven, more oriented toward what is the real practical effect of this type of thing.
You're into your reserve time.
Having said that, I can stand down and look forward to speaking to you again. Thank you.
Good afternoon, may it please the court. My name is Josh Aiklin from Lewis Brisbois. I represent the real parties in interest in this matter, the Pacific Ave Properties Group, the Renickers as individuals, and Cheyenne Apartments, PPG. We're starting from an incorrect premise, and that is that there was actually a settlement here. If you look at the history of this
case, you didn't cross-petition for writ relief from the determination of good faith settlement, though, did you?
No, we argued that they argued that there was a good faith petition or a good faith settlement. We argued that there was not.
But there's an order that says there is, correct?
Well, there's an order from the trial court that says there is.
And counsel, this matter was before the court twice as a good faith settlement. First time was rejected at the $45,000 mark, and the second time a much higher figure, about four times, was approved by the court, and the parties objected. The first time the court sustained the objection, the second time the court approved the settlement. So,
yes, Your Honor.
It's been vetted at some points.
So we can't revisit it, is the point. What we have before us is that order that establishes a good faith settlement.
Right, and the question becomes, how can you settle a case if, in fact, the claims of the plaintiffs had been dismissed prior to the time of the settlement? So the settlement that was reached was actually from $210,000. The $45,000 settlement was rejected.
Right, I'm sorry.
But the settlement that was reached for the $210,000 was reached between parties who had dismissed their claims. So how can we call it a settlement? How can we say that it's a good faith settlement when, in fact, what happened was there were no claims or causes of action then existing when the $210,000 was paid? Those had been dismissed in February of 2010. The settlements were done in March of 2011.
So this order that we have before us is void?
Yes, ma'am. There was no causes of action pending. If you look at the record, and we put this in the briefs, if you look at the record, there were no causes of action pending. They'd been dismissed without prejudice. And a dismissal without prejudice after the statute ran means that they can't be refiled. So it was effectively the same as a dismissal with prejudice. There were no claims to settle. Now, if you get beyond that and you look at the value of the settlements, the cumulative settlements in these cases were $6,728,000. For OTAC to say it was not actively negligent is arguing the facts of the case. And that's what the judge found. You have to go take the facts of the case to a trial of fact and say, what is OTAC's negligence in this case? And in fact, OTAC did not inspect the meetings. It was supposed to have somebody there every day and did not. And they were actively negligent.
Counsel, on this good faith settlement, didn't we have a battle of the experts on both sides, producing information as to the contractual provisions and such, and the court heard that and made a decision, but both parties, PCS and the other, and PR, as well as OTEC, presented experts, and the court had to make a decision as to good faith.
Well,
you're going back into it as if nothing was actually done, and in fact, the court held a full good faith settlement as to what was there.
There was no actual discovery done between my clients and OTEC, Your Honor. There was no depositions taken, any of those things. So the court did not have a complete record when it evaluated the good faith settlement.
So are you asking us to overturn the good faith settlement determination? If so, by what procedural vehicle do you bring that to us?
It was ruled ab initio, Your Honor, that there was no case pending at the time that the $210,000 was paid. And therefore, the court's order granting it is granting a nullity because there was no case, there was no claim, there was no cause of action pending between the two.
Did you argue that in front of the district judge?
We did argue that, Your Honor. It was raised in the trial court level. It was also raised within our opposition to the writ, this writ amended.
From my standpoint, I would be more interested in hearing your opposition to the 17245 argument as it pertains to the express contract claims, express indemnity claims asserted in the third party complaint.
Yes, ma'am. OTAC contracted with Cheyenne Apartments, and they were to provide all the professional services on the contract, including the civil architecture. Then OTAC subcontracted those out to Orion, and within that subcontract, there is an indemnity clause. It's labeled an indemnity clause. And I want to read it to the court because it's extremely clear in what it says. Now, it's a little unclear as to the second part, but it's extremely clear. It says, to the extent permitted by law, consultant Orion shall indemnify, hold harmless, and defend OTAC, Cheyenne Apartments PPG Limited Partnership, my clients, and its respective representatives, officers, directors, and employees, who would be the Renickers, from any loss of claim made by third parties, including legal costs, fees and costs, of defending actions or suits, resulting directly or indirectly from consultant Orion's performance or non-performance in the agreement. where the loss or claim is attributable to the negligence or other fault of Orion, its employees, representatives, or subcontractors. And here's the key language. If the loss or claim is caused by the joint or concurrent negligence or other fault of architect, OTEC, and consultant Orion, the loss or claim shall be borne by each in proportion to the degree of negligence or other fault attributable to each. We need to remember what this paragraph in the contract is talking about. It's talking about express indemnity of Cheyenne. Also OTEC, but it's talking about express indemnity of Cheyenne. So what it's saying here, and recall that OTEC wrote this contract. OTEC put that language in it. The contract is talking about the express contractual indemnity of Cheyenne. And what it...
Correct that there was a clause in the contract between OTEC and the owner or the general contractor that there shall be no express indemnity?
They had removed that from the contract, but they did not remove that from this contract, Your Honor.
Okay.
And this contract was drafted by OTEC. They're the ones that put the name.
So the main contract is silent on it, and the negotiating history would show that it had an express indemnity clause that was stricken? Is that the state of the main contract?
It was that it was never included in the main contract.
But does the negotiating history show it was stricken?
Yes, I believe it was taken out by OTEC. I'm not certain, but I believe that it was taken out by OTEC. But it wasn't taken out of this one. Now,
why isn't the last sentence of the paragraph you read a sentence that provides for contribution by OTEC, not express indemnity?
Because it's actually talking about the paragraph itself is talking about indemnifying Cheyenne Apartments. And it says the loss. It says from where the loss or claim is attributable to the negligence. And then later down in the contract it says the loss or claim.
So it's talking about that. That's an interesting reading. The contract says Orion shall indemnify. It doesn't say OTEC shall indemnify. And yet your claim is for indemnification. Contractual indemnification.
Yes, Your Honor, because later...
Why do you have the right to seek contribution from OTEC? Wouldn't only Orion have the right to seek contribution from OTEC under this clause?
No, sir. We are an expressed named third-party beneficiary of this indemnity agreement. We are listed in it, and therefore we would have standing to assert our express indemnity rights. Now, if we go back to the contract language, we need to remember if there is an ambiguity basis, then it was written by OTEC. It talks about the claim, and Orion will defend and indemnify Cheyenne and its agents and officers for the claim. And then later on it says, but if OTEC is also negligent, then the contribution will be based upon the percentages of fault. And remember, that's in the indemnity paragraph that was written by OTEC. It was taken out of other contracts.
But the bond under 17.245 expressly extends to contribution claims.
But not contractual indemnity claims, Your Honor. OTEC wrote the contract, therefore if there's an ambiguity, it has to be interpreted against OTEC. The court looked at this issue at the trial court level and said, you know what, there's an express indemnity clause here in Article 10. We need to have a finder of fact look at that, and I think counsel reinforced that during his oral argument. He says, there's been no breach of the agreement here. That's a factual question. That's a question that needs to go back in front of the jury and determine, was OTEC actively negligent? And what percentage was it? And remember, too, that my client, the property owner, hired these people as experts and relied upon them. So there's a question of active versus passive negligence here. And that also has to go back to the trial court level. Does that answer your question?
Not completely, but enough.
I will actually, if there are no questions, I would step down and reserve my remaining time for that.
There's no...
No, I'm sorry. You're right. Are there any questions?
I have a question in terms of any discussion as the Department of Taxation for Denver Chrysler as to the issue of the basically the 1997 amendment.
I'm sorry, I don't understand you.
What I'm looking at is in terms of holding that statutory emissions are deemed intentional, in terms of when the statute was reworded, not to specifically exclude something or to include it, as we're talking about
now,
under 17.
Thank you, sir. Yeah, there are claims in this third-party complaint for a breach of contract, but also a breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing, which would be an intentional act. There's a prayer for punitive damages. That would be an intentional act. That would also not be covered within
the punitive damages need a predicate intentional tort. They're not a separate claim for relief, are they?
No, ma'am. They're a prayer, but that would be based upon the breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing, which would be a separate reason.
If we deny the extraordinary writ, what happens to the 210? Has that been paid? Is it over?
That money has been paid. It's been paid to the plaintiffs.
Do you know how many states that have adopted the 1955 version of the Uniform Contribution and Joint Tort Feasors Act have language like ours that includes, that extinguishes both contribution and equitable indemnity as opposed to just contribution?
No, ma'am, I do not.
Because that was the 97 amendments to add in equitable indemnity, correct?
Yes, ma'am. Okay, are there any other questions? Okay. If I could, I'd like to go back to the issue about the good faith settlement.
Of course.
If we look at the MGM factors within the good faith settlement, just looking at the amount, OTAC grossly underpaid. They paid less than 3%. And they were an actively negligent party in this case. They paid $100,000 to the Becerra plaintiffs, where our clients were paid $2 million. They paid $70,000 to the Watkin plaintiffs, where our client paid $950,000.
Counsel, aren't we back where we started, that should be tested at the district court level in the determination of good faith settlement?
And it was, Your Honor. It was raised and it was objected to by our clients, and the issue has been briefed on the if you look at the amount of the coverage under the MGM standards, there was a $2 million policy here that was $210,000 paid. So the amount of coverage would not support it. But the most, and the other thing too is, OTAC here was actively negligent in the construction of this property. And none of those things were ever been able to test it. Now, because of the good faith settlement and the wiping out the equitable contribution claims, we can't go back and get our monies that were paid for their act of negligence, where we were passively, if at all, we were passively negligent. And that is a miscarriage of justice.
Parcel of what the trial court judge considered in making a good faith determination?
It would be, Your Honor, you're right. The standard is, and the standard
agree with him, but
you're right. I mean, the standard is an abuse of discretion standard. So you've got to remember that the claims had been dismissed before he said, oh, here's a settlement where we're releasing
something. That goes back to your other argument, but now you're actually contesting his good faith determination.
Absolutely.
And the abuse of discretion is where exactly?
Well, to say that it's a good faith settlement where, in fact, they're paying, they basically weren't their volunteers. They paid $210,000.
Well, the intention of getting $45,000 that was offered up the first time that planners were apparently willing to accept. And doesn't that just presuppose that here was a finding that there was only minor responsibility, that consistent with some of the case law that's out there?
See, the plaintiffs were willing to accept it because they knew any money was a windfall because they didn't have any active causes of action against the defendants. So any money into their pockets, whether it's $45,000 or $210,000, is a windfall. And the cases say where there's a recovery that's a windfall of a plaintiff, then that militates against the good faith nature of the settlement. See, my time is just running out, so I thank you very much. It's been an honor.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Two very brief points. First, the argument that OTAC's good faith settlement was illusory because there was no active claim pleading is a new one on me. I looked and I don't see that as being addressed in the reply, but the fact was, OTAC was in this case, it was ordered to go to a mandatory settlement conference before Judge Williams,
They were there for 2 days. They negotiated a settlement that got Judge Williams sealed approval, such as it is valued to, and then they applied for good faith determination. So that, and they received a release from the plaintiffs. So that is a clear exercise of the options available to it to affect a settlement and discharge itself from claims from third-party tort fees.
This is indicating that they were already discharged, that there was no claim to settle.
As I said, I'm unaware of that because there were cross-claims pending. OTAC 1 disposed of two of them. And I have confidence in former counsel that if they knew they were not in the case, they wouldn't have shown up at a mandatory settlement conference where they were not a party. But I think the bigger driver of where this case is ending up is counsel's argument that somehow the settlement should be unwound. This settlement was negotiated 2 years ago this month. What kind of a remedy can this court craft? Order the funds paid back, order the plaintiffs back of the case, set aside a dismissal. It's an untenable and impossible situation. And the reason we're here now, again, is because of the respondent court's failure to give 17245 the deference that I think it was due. So having said that, we fully appreciate your attention to this today, and I appreciate the time you spent with us.
Thank you very much. We'll stand at ease until the next matter.
Chief, you have to submit the case.
Oh, we'll submit the case.